This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. Just for members' information, we have a lot of, because we're going to be having a lot of big health reform packages before the committee, they will take a lot of time. They're not all ready yet. Like, I think the Healthcare Access Commission one will be in several weeks. But they will take priority in the committee, getting them heard. But we have lots of other bills, many of them very important bills, and so we will have a full agenda. And looking at the, I think it's 8 weeks we have until first deadline, we will be having, unfortunately, a lot of evening meetings as well, and we will be starting with them. We will be starting with them soon, too. So I just want members to be aware of that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Corrin.
Mr. Chairman, I would just say that I, not certainly never telling the chair what to do, but I would encourage the members of this committee to try to get here on time. So, because I'm one that I don't really particularly like meeting at night. If we would get here on time, we could already had 15 minutes of testimony today. So I would hope that we can, and also being respectful of anybody that has traveled long distances, I think it shows that we respect their time also. So I would just say that on my behalf.
Senator Corrin, that's a point well taken, and I think the Senate often has very poor habits in timeliness, and we will make a point of talking with other committee members about that as well, as the ones who are not here should hear that as well. But we will try and minimize the evening meetings because it is a hassle for not just committee members but for the public and witnesses as well. But we will be having some. I just wanted committee members to be aware of that. With that, we will begin with Senator Sharon's bill.
Good afternoon, Senator.
Welcome to the committee. Your first bill this year.
It is my first bill, so I'm really pleased that it is this bill. And I appreciate Chairman Marty and members of the committee that you're giving us some time to hear this bill today. The first thing I'd like to do in terms of Senate File 2471 is offer an author's amendment.
We are one person short of a, maybe we're
Senator
now.
Against us here.
We need one more. We'll offer the amendment when it comes. So just go ahead with the presentation.
I'll just explain the amendment then, because it's the language changes the overall bill. So I want to be sure that everybody understands that Senate File 2471 is a blood donation bill that changes the age that a donor can be in order to give blood. And so in the language of the original bill, it says a person who is 15 or 16 years of age. What is being changed in the amendment is dropping the age 15. And by dropping the age 15, we were able to resolve concerns that the pediatricians had in relationship to the bill. And it's also important that you note that we're talking about, in this bill, allowing persons 16 years of age to donate blood in a voluntary and non-compensatory, I mean it cannot be sold or income be created because of the donation, and it can occur only if the person, the 16-year-old, obtains written permission from the person's parent or guardian. So that is the essence of the bill, and the amendment drops the 15 years, and it is only going to apply to a 16-year-old, and changes the effective date. So I don't know if you have a quorum and you want to take a
question. No, so just go ahead with your witnesses then.
It's really quiet. I hope you can hear me, and I have a cold, so that may be making it difficult as well. I have with me today the person who initiated this bill. That's what makes it a very special bill for all of us, really, in the Senate. So I'll be introducing you to Joe Gibson, who himself is 16 years old, has a very interesting story to tell you about how this bill was created and how he brought it forward. He's from Blooming Prairie, Minnesota. It's about 20 miles south of Owatonna, and it's a community of about 2,000 people. And he's going to tell a story to you about what happened that created his interest in introducing this bill. And also with me is Rick Panning, who is the chief executive officer of the American Red Cross and also the North Central Blood Services. And Dr. Jed Gorlin, who is from the Memorial Blood Centers and is the medical director of the Transfusion Services of Hennepin County General. And he's brought with him a student as well who is doing a residency and is a post-year resident, one-year post-residency. So we have lots of people here today to learn about our process and who are interested in this project. So with that, what I'm going to do is introduce you to Joe, who is going to be presenting to you the background that brought him here and what connected him with Representative Patty Fritz, who's been working with Joe on this bill for some time, and she's also here to support Joe in the presentation of this bill, which is really his bill.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Gibson, and like Senator said, I'm from Blooming Prairie, Minnesota, and I was kind of the spark that created this bill. Approximately 2 years ago, my grandfather previously had been diagnosed with cancer. Some of you may know cancer is very hard on the body, obviously we all know that, but transfusions, blood transfusions, can really impact a person's life when they have cancer. And I saw that my grandfather had several transfusions that really did improve his standard of living for up to a month at a time. Also, he received several surgeries that required blood. So it was kind of a given that he would be taking blood transfusions and during the surgeries having blood. That kind of got my background on the blood donation program into my system here. But all this really started when approximately 2 years ago I was walking out of the locker room at football practice and walked by the commons in our high school, which is kind of a little meeting place, and they were doing a blood drive there, the Red Cross. There were several of us standing there, and then about three or four elderly ladies walked in, signed all the papers, and went and donated blood. And we thought, that's a great thing to do. Why don't we do it? So I walked up to the table and asked how I could do this. They turned me away because I was not old enough. I was told that you have to be 17 in Minnesota to donate blood. At this time, I was 15. So after that, I thought about what to do, and I ended up having a bunch of my classmates and teachers sign a petition that I had typed up, and I sent to Representative Fritz. And she was great, and within a couple of days called me back and said, I like the idea of, you know, lowering the age that we can donate blood here in Minnesota, and let's get together and talk about it. And for the past 2 years, we've been working on this, and now we've gotten it to this point. It's really important to me, too, because it has such personal meaning, something that I can do to remember my grandfather and other people like him. And Representative Fritz, as a nurse, saw how blood transfusions could help people. And the national shortage of blood in the United States, this just seemed like a good thing to do. So here I am, doing the right thing, I hope.
Very well. You've got a great idea, and I thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, I would like to introduce you to Rick Panning, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross.
Senator Marty, I'm here representing the American Red Cross, and I'm here with my colleague, Dr. Jed Gorlin from Memorial Blood Center. And although Mayo Clinic could not send a representative today, they also have written a letter of support. All three of the organizations that collect blood from donors in the state of Minnesota are supportive of this bill. As Joe has already mentioned, there is a consistent, constant need for blood in this country. The donor age, people are getting older, and the donor population that typically gives blood is aging and not able to give blood as often, and we need to build the donor base in this country. And by passing this bill to lower the donor age to 16, we'll expand the donor base. I think it provides us a couple of opportunities. One is to obviously physically expand the donor base, but the other is to give these people an opportunity to donate earlier in life, to develop a habit and to learn about that donation and the need for that donation, but also we hope for a side benefit of maybe educating their parents about also donating blood and building the donor base that way. There are several states in the country, currently 15, that already have a lower donor age than Minnesota. Just states around us include Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, and just recently, within the last 2 weeks, the legislature in Wisconsin has passed a similar bill, which is currently waiting the governor's signature in that state. So in summary and very basically, there's a consistent need for blood. It doesn't ebb and flow. It's consistent, and we need to build a donor base, and we believe that the passage of this bill will help serve that purpose.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coring.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Senator Sharon, thank you for your work on this. I want to direct my remarks to Mr. Gibson. You know, up here at the legislature, we've got a crisis in health care, and we've got a crisis in education. It seems like there's a crisis all the time, and I, for one, sometimes feel overwhelmed, and it just seems like the world is crumbling almost sometimes. But I got to tell you that there are times, and today is one of them, when I see somebody like you come before our committee. It restores my faith that I know that the world is still in good hands, and I'm so proud of you for stepping up to the plate and being an activist on this part. You're doing a great thing, and it's people like you that change the world and make it better for everybody. And so I just want to tell you, I'm so proud of you, and I'm just glad you're not in my district, because I'd be afraid you'd run against me. But I know I speak on behalf of the entire committee to say that we're so proud of you and the work that you're doing. You're making a difference in not only in the state, but I'm sure that you'll go out after you're done with high school and make a difference in the world. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And I also want to say that I became interested in politics when I got on the Farm Bureau Board of Directors a long, long time ago. And I had a visualization of an old gentleman, and I don't even know if he's alive anymore, but he used to come to the Farm Bureau meetings, and he had a lot of lapel pins on his lapel. And he had one that was a 10-gallon pin. That's a lot of blood. And he was really proud of that. So, again, Mr. Gibson, I want to thank you for all that you're doing and all that you will continue to do. So, thank you.
Thank you.
And I think his words speak for the whole committee's attitude about it. So, thank you.
One more presenter, Dr. Jed Gorlin from the Memorial Blood Centers. And while he's settling himself here, I want you to know that there's some materials in front of you, some letters of support from the organizations that want to assure you that this is a good bill and is one that you can feel comfortable supporting.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, committee. And thank you for letting me present. Alas, us baby boomers are graying, and our warranties are expiring. And as they expire, we need more and more medical procedures. But alas, the donor base is shrinking, both because of increased requirements and because of those many medical conditions. So something that expands the donor base like this is useful. Drawing blood is a medical procedure, and any medical procedures do have risks. And before someone donates blood, there is a signed informed consent process that explains all those risks. For the purpose of lowering the, right now you can donate blood down to age 17 without parental permission, and the wording of this bill would not change that. But for the purpose of lowering it to 16, the 16-year-olds would require parental permission. And we have mechanisms in place to obtain paper consent prior to those donations. The younger you are, the lighter in weight you are, first-time donations do have a higher rate of feeling a little faint, but there are ways of mitigating those risks, and we would work together with the other two blood-drawing agencies to try to decrease those risks as much as possible. So in the end, we see this as a very net benefit and risks that are certainly mitigatable. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Garland. Question about before the author's amendment is put on, the decision to change it to 16, was that concerns from blood banks or medical professionals, or was that concerns about the politics of it, or...
Although it was mentioned that the pediatric group had some concerns, it was actually concerns by Dr. Mayer at the Red Cross, Mayo, Dr. Winter at Mayo, myself. There is clear data from several studies that the younger you are, the greater the risk. There are other states that allow 15-year-olds. In virtually no other state does any blood center actually collect from 15-year-olds. There's plenty of precedent and documentation of safety from 16. We think that's enough. There are 16 other states, I believe, that allow it age 16. There are at least two that do 15, but nobody actually draws it. California is one.
Senator Lynch moves the A1 author's amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there further discussion on the bill? Is there anybody who wishes to speak in opposition or with concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2471 as amended be recommended to pass. And this goes straight to the – there's no financial
goes
impact.
To the floor.
Go right straight to the floor.
Consent.
I don't have to consent calendar on this. I don't think. No, Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2471 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank
you very
much,
and best wishes, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you for your time.
Senator Shy just walked in the room. Senator Bergman, is that okay if we take her first?
It's fine.
Senator Shy, good timing.
I thought I was going to move that bill.
Too bad, I didn't.
You can move the next. You weren't gone.
I was just right here.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Scheid. You're the second bill on our agenda.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Isn't it? It's kind of neat to be, we're doing bills right away, and I just listened to the last bill. What a great idea. I didn't even know that age was a factor, so I congratulate you. Senate File 1326 was introduced last year, and I feel somewhat apologetic because it wasn't in a year when we had some money, if you will. We didn't have money to do this, and now I'm coming to you in a year when to say we don't have money is an understatement, right? Yet it is something. It represents something that the state wants to do. I don't know the extent of the commitment, but I think it's been for some time. It involves a residential facility of 32. They have 32 beds. You have 31 people there now in Brooklyn Park, homeward bound. And some members may recall thinking about the mid-'90s. You did what we're asking for this one. You did that for a larger homeward bound facility in New Hope. And I think it was an even larger facility, double this, I think. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, and I think the state policy, federal policy, has been that we want people, these are profoundly disabled individuals. They get wonderful care there. But yet we want the residents to be able to live in a smaller setting. I think that even if this is 32 beds, I think that's considered institutional. Mm-hmm. And we want to move away from that. And Homeward Bound is looking to do 4 6-bed homes mm-hmm. instead of having everybody in this one building, in this one complex of, well, it's one building of 32 beds. The catch-22 is that the state has a disincentive to continuing this kind of an institutional facility, and yet we aren't funding the kind of setting we want people to be in. The smaller settings, obviously it would require 4 buildings rather than this one big one. And I think this was built almost 30 years ago, 1979. It needs work. I don't know about the roof, but most roofs, about 30 years, you need to do something, mm-hmm. if not before, and other kinds of upgrades that would have to. I know that there's asbestos. That's an issue. So if we're not going to be able to pay for people to be in smaller settings, then we're going to be dealing with paying a big chunk of money to redo or to rehab this building. I have Mr. Don Preby with me from Homeward Bound, and he will give you much more detail. This is kind of out of my comfort level in terms of having any experience with the funding and the way these things work, but I've been to Homeward Bound, and I know people who work there, and it's a wonderful facility. It's very near my home, actually. And yet I also understand why we want the residents there to be able to live in smaller settings. So with that, I'll introduce Mr. Preby and let him tell you, give you more of the fundamentals.
Thank you, Senator. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Shide. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Preby, P-R-I-E-B-E. I'm the CEO of Homeward Bound. That operates the facility we're talking about in Brooklyn Park. I'm here to urge the passage of Senate File 1326, which we hope will eliminate the bleak future for the 31 folks who live there, 31 folks with severe disabilities. And by severe disabilities, I really mean three things. I mean folks who have profound to severe levels of intellectual disability, meaning mental retardation or traumatic brain injury, folks who have severe physical disabilities, which means they get around in wheelchairs, they cannot communicate or need extensive help communicating, and may even need staff intervention for range of motion and doing such simple things as shifting their position in a chair. I also mean folks with medical conditions that need sophisticated nursing care or may involve life-threatening conditions. We've been working on the future of Brooklyn Park for a long time. We've worked with the folks in the Disabilities Division at Hennepin County, with the folks at ARC, and we've been consulting with the folks in the Disabilities Division at DHS. And we've developed the plan to relocate the facility by constructing and opening four smaller six-bed homes, moving the residents there, and then closing the existing facility. And Senate File 1326 is designed to both allow the state to license those facilities and to also fund both the increases in costs that we would need to continue the new services and provide an interim rate that would be limited to 12 months to fund the closure of the home. We've come to the legislature because while DHS can authorize the relocations of facilities, on its own they cannot raise payment rates. The rates that we currently have in effect are not sufficient to cover either the costs of the downsizing or the increased costs of the new services. Essentially, our plan is this, that the legislation envisions, is we would work with the Hennepin County case management and disabilities planning folks and the families at Brooklyn Park to create a plan for doing this downsizing. We would see through an assessment process which folks at the facility would be eligible for what's called a CAC waiver, which is a home and community-based waiver that serves folks who have lots of hospitalizations. And then for those folks who would be ineligible for that waiver, we would have these four homes constructed. That's why the numbers don't perfectly match, 24 folks versus 31 folks. One of the ICFs we're proposing to develop, the most expensive one, would feature both 24-hour nursing and it would be for people who didn't leave during the day for day program. So when we say 24-hour, we mean 24-hour. The second most expensive ICF would serve folks who also need 24-hour services, nursing services, but who do leave during the day for DT&H. And then the third and the fourth homes would feature daily nursing for folks, and they would also leave for DT&H. To give you some idea about our organization and the folks who live there, We've passed out a copy of our latest annual report that can give you a little bit of a picture of the organization. We were started in 1973. We're a nonprofit organization, and we were started in 1973 by parents who had families with kids who had the severe disabilities that I'm talking about. We bounced around for a number of years until we built a building in New Hope for 64 folks. And then in 1979, as Senator Scheid mentioned, we built a facility in Brooklyn Park for adults. And the home for kids was for 64, and the home for the adults is for 32. I think it's fair to say that the people who live at Brooklyn Park now are amongst the most vulnerable Minnesotans that you can imagine. To give you some key indicators about them, about 25% of the folks who live there have life-threatening conditions. Half the people who live there require 24-hour nursing. Everybody who lives there uses wheelchairs to get around and requires total care for all of their self-care needs. And then to give you some idea of the health care needs, we have about 8,300 medications prescribed for just the 31 folks. And over the course of a year, we'll make 190,000 administrations of those medications. There are really four reasons why we're coming to you and proposing this change. One of them is what Senator Scheid alluded to, which is state and federal policy to move from institutional or larger services to smaller services. But we're also coming to you because, as she mentioned, the state has put financial disincentives in the place of operating these larger facilities. And yet we're in a catch-22 because there's no mechanism for us to access the kinds of resources that we need to have in order to accomplish what the state wants us to do. What are some of the disincentives that I'm talking about? There's no money currently available for downsizing larger ICFs. A program that was begun in 1999 was eliminated in the 2002-2003 legislature called the Profile Program or Automatic Variable Rates. What it allowed facilities to do was to capture more resources as their people got needier and needier and needier. That program was eliminated. Frankly, it cost Brooklyn Park about $100,000 a year when that program was gone. In addition, what used to be 20%, now it's been modified to 10% of the state funding for Brooklyn Park has to come from Hennepin County. So now the counties have an incentive to want to move in the direction that we're talking about. Two, the effect of all of these of all of these changes has really been to sort of centralize ICF rate setting in the legislature. It may seem like a kind of a crazy system to come to you guys and ask for money in this way, but this net effect of all of these changes over the years has evolved to the point where it's the legislature really with the only legal authority to give us the kinds of resources that we need to do this. So it's as you can imagine, it's difficult in the best of times to operate these facilities. It's particularly difficult when you're sailing against the winds of state policy. In addition, we're suffering huge financial losses, and there's no mechanism to recover those losses. In the last 5 years, we've lost between $40,000 and $90,000 a year at the program. The health care needs of the folks who live there are dramatically going up. One figure that I'll give you is the number of hospitalized days of the folks who live there have increased 40% in the last 5 years. In 2006, people at Brooklyn Park were hospitalized for a total of 179 days. And also, as Senator Scheid mentioned, we have an aging building without the resources to update it to run for the future. a flat roof. We need kitchens and bathrooms remodeled. We're not compliant with the ADA, all of which we estimate would cost us somewhere around $600,000 to do that. I did want to mention that, as Senator Scheid alluded to in the past, this has been done. We came to the legislature in the mid-1990s for help in closing our New Hope program for kids. The legislature did grant our request. We closed the building, and those folks are now living out in the community. And I think it's also a fair question to ask, why should Homeward Bound be singled out here? There are 220 ICFs in the state. Why Homeward Bound? We think it's because of the vulnerability of the people who live there. We don't know what kind of systemic change will happen for ICFs in the future. We don't know when it will happen and whether it would be sufficient for us to continue to operate. I do want to assure the committee, folks are doing fine now. We're doing good services. In fact, we were full about 97-98% of the time in 2007. So clearly we're doing something right. I guess what I'm trying to do is to come before, to come to the legislature and the department and the county and say, can we act before we get in trouble, before the services have reached a point where we have a crisis? Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of the bill. I'd certainly be
thank
interested
you, Mr.
in
Preeby.
Questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Corrigan, Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And it's Mr. Preeby?
Yes.
Is it? Mr. Preeby. First of all, I appreciate your testimony, and I'm glad to hear you say that the folks that are staying there are being well taken care of. That's good. And I understand what you're doing. But I'm hoping that the only reason that you're doing it, not the only reason that you're doing it because of financial things, I would like to think that if you go from a 32-bed facility to a six-bed facility, mm-hmm. I would hope that you're doing it and having the patient, or I don't know if patient is the right word, but having the folks that stay there, that they're, that's your first concern. Before, obviously, we always have to think about money, but obviously I want to make sure that you're doing it for all the right reasons, and I hope that mm-hmm. you're not just running after money. You're doing it because you feel in your heart that these people are going to have better care. Now, is that sound like what you're doing? Or?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, the advantages of smaller places are pretty well established in research, and one of the reasons why we're doing this is to go along with state policy and federal policy to reduce the sizes. It's pretty clear that folks who live in smaller places have a higher quality of life. Mm-hmm. They have more choice. They see their families more often. They get out into the community more. You know, there's less noise and commotion. It's easier for them to get staff attention. And frankly, what we found in some cases is their health even improves. We mm-hmm. opened a home about a year ago that works with folks who have very high medical needs where they have 24-hour nursing. The folks came from this facility, and before they came, they had a lot of hospitalizations. After they left and went to our smaller facility, they haven't spent one day in the hospital. So it's really clear our folks benefit dramatically from living in a smaller place. So that is part of why we're doing this. Absolutely.
And if I could just, Mr. Chairman, I would just say, well, thank you for the work you're doing, and I know this is a policy committee, so we don't talk about money here, but I would just say that you've got an uphill battle, certainly, but you never know unless you ask. So, Mr. Chairman, when the questions are done, I would certainly be honored to move Senator Scheid's bill when that's appropriate.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Preeby, thank you for coming. And
thank you.
I've been looking at your material provided, and it's a very compelling story. And I think all of us, I certainly have residents in my district that have relatives or children with profound disabling conditions, and it's a very challenging struggle for families to go through, and I can't help but think that what you're doing is just a great blessing to a lot of people, and we appreciate it. I just wanted to ask you a question. You talked about one of the rationales to make this change was that it's sort of the direction of federal policy and state policy to do this, and I believe that you're right, that smaller facilities are beneficial in many ways for families and for the residents themselves. I've always understood that one of the other reasons was that the argument was it was less costly to care for patients, and maybe I'm wrong about that, but you mentioned that you are looking at higher reimbursements to cover higher costs, and I'm just, am I in error in thinking that moving to smaller or home-type care facilities are not less costly? I understood that was one of the rationales for the policy shift. But
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the answer is in general the smaller facilities are less costly. If you look at, I think what the department likes to do, for instance, is look at all of the folks receiving services. And in general, then, if they live in the community, it's less expensive. In our one narrow example, it's obviously more expensive to live in the community than in the institution. Although, clearly, we're not getting what people need now, so it should be more expensive at the institution as well.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and thank you, Mr. Priebe. Just kind of to follow up on that, and you'd mentioned the change would result in the loss of a number of places for residents, and you talked about that the goal was to move some of the residents you currently have into, you mentioned a waiver, was it the CATI waiver?
CAC waiver.
And I'm not completely familiar with that. I've heard of that. Maybe could you tell us a little bit about that, and is the idea that by doing this waivered service that that is a cost reduction from being in the facility, and it would it be arguable to say that 31 residents in the current structure and then 31, some of them under the waiver and some of them in the new facility, would the net cost to the state be comparable or maybe less? I mean, is that part of what you're describing?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the answer is yes. The CAC waiver stands for Community Alternative Care. It's one of the home and community-based waivers, and it was designed to serve people who have chronic or acute health care needs and are hospitalized a lot. So in that case, it's a little different from some of the other home and community-based waivers, for instance, that may target people with developmental disabilities or people with traumatic brain injury. In the one CAC home that we operate, we have one individual there without intellectual disabilities, and we have three people with intellectual disabilities, but all four of them have chronic health needs that result in numerous hospitalizations. And the purpose of the CAC home is to intensify services so we divert people from hospital stays, which can be very, very expensive, given some of the averages that I've seen for these kinds of things. So using the CAC waiver is advantageous for everyone in this situation where it applies to folks, because there are budgets set up to pay the kinds of services and rates that people need.
Thank you.
So that's why we're aiming for the CAC waiver eligibility assessments early on in the process.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Higgins.
Senator Scheid had a comment.
Oh, Senator Scheid,
I'm sorry.
Chairman,
forgive me. I think there is an amendment.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to
if
that.
You would, you're learning about that. Okay, and yeah. That's fine. I'll let
yes,
now,
Senator Coring wanted to offer the bill, so Senator Higgins will offer the technical amendment.
Oh, all right.
The A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I offer the A2 amendment.
And
it's a delete all.
I believe that the first three sections, which are totally different, were adopted last year. They're in law, but we have to restate them here. Is that right, Mr. Giel?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
On the A2 technical amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak with concern? Senator Higgins.
Actually, I did have questions. Mr. Priebe, I have a couple questions. Is this rate a per-day rate, a per-day per-patient rate?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, it is.
Okay.
It's a per-day rate.
And what is the current rate that you're being paid in the 32-bed facility now?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the current rate is $315.82.
So, So, Mr. Chair, so you're going, that's a significant rate, and that may just be a reflection of how poorly the reimbursement rate is, but at $475 a day, that's about $170-some thousand a year. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the $475.77 is for one of the homes, mm-hmm. The home that's going to have 24-hour nursing where nobody leaves during the day for day program. If you turn the bill over, there is another rate for the second home at $402 a day and 95 cents. That's for folks who need 24-hour nursing and do go to day program. And then the third and the fourth home has a rate of $343.64. That's for people who need substantial nursing and also will go to day program.
And then, Mr. Chair, the fifth rate that's there is the existing facility has a new rate even higher than the first one. Oh, I'm looking at the old language. Is it in this one, too? It's in this one, too.
Yeah.
You're
correct.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's the interim rate for the existing facility that would stay in effect for 1 year to fund the closure of the building.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Preeby, I'm sorry, at home in my neighborhood, it's Preeb, so I'm having a hard time catching that little difference. Mm-hmm. So that's almost a $200 a day increase in the existing facility, and not quite that much in a couple of the others. That's mm-hmm. that's pretty significant.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the reason why the number is so high is as people move out of the facility, your revenues drop, but you still have to keep operating about the same facility. As folks move out, you can cut down, for instance, numbers of staff. And so what you do is you work out a budget and a schedule of when you think people will leave. And then you estimate the revenues that you're going to lose, and then you make adjustment to the rate over the 12-month period to see. The monies in the interim rate that we don't spend are returned to the department at the end. Typically what happens in these situations is the department does an audit after the building is closed to see what you've really spent, and you return monies that are not spent.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Corrigan.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up on a couple of questions in relation to Senator Higgins' questions. I guess I'm really kind of surprised. What did you say it was, like $171,000? You know, a good friend of mine's mother-in-law just passed away, and she had Alzheimer's for 12 years, and it was a private pay, and they were paying it themselves. And obviously it's on level of care, but it was about $6,000 a month. So that's about $72,000 a year. Why is this so, I mean, this is $100,000 a year more, and somebody with Alzheimer's certainly is going to have a lot of, I mean, this lady had to be fed. Mm-hmm. And so she, I don't know how that anybody could have need any more care than that. So mm-hmm. where does that other $100,000 factor in? I guess I'm actually kind of just shocked by this, really.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's expensive to serve people with these kinds of needs. People who need total care, who not only have to be fed but freshened up and have to be moved. In addition, these homes are licensed as intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, which means that they have federal certification. There's a whole list of federal regulations that we have to meet in order to retain our licensure. We're surveyed once a year by the Minnesota Health Department, and one of the differences perhaps between folks with Alzheimer's and the sort of folks who live at Brooklyn Park is where folks with Alzheimer's receive medical care and receive room and board kinds of services, feeding and that sort of thing. We also have to provide what's called active treatment to individuals who live in these facilities. By that, I mean we have to have a routine plan for each day where we try and teach them and habilitate them with various skills and quality of life kinds of changes. So there's a lot of intensive training and programming that goes on in addition to the health care. But the bulk of the increase is currently at Brooklyn Park we have two nurses for 32 individuals or one for every 16 people. In this category, in this situation, we'll have one nurse for every six people, or sometimes one nurse for every three people. Nurses are expensive. There's no doubt about it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could just ask one more question, and then I don't want to prolong this because I know that this will come before the Health and Human Services Budget Division, and I'll be able to ask other questions. But let's just say that the folks went into a six-bed facility. How many people would be working there? Would there be a one-on-one? Would there be six people every eight-hour shift, or how many people would it take? And are those people? I mean, do you have to have like a registered nurse? You know, I mean, I can see then that you'd have to pay wages, but if you're paying somebody, you know, $10 an hour to work at one of these, you know, holy smokes, I'm wondering where the money goes. But
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have staffing patterns for the programs, and obviously in the first program with the highest rate, it's more intensive staffing. Generally, we would have one to two nurses on during the time when people were awake, not registered nurses, LPNs. But even LPNs are sometimes paid in the very high teens and the low 20s now because of the nursing shortage. And then we would typically also have three staff on, as well as the nursing staff. One of the things we have to provide, especially in the more expensive home where people don't leave during the day, is we have to provide the equivalent of DT&H or day program services to folks while they're at home. So that's another reason why it can be more expensive in the most expensive home.
If there's no more.
Okay. Senator Dahl has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Priebe. I haven't been out to Homeward Bound, so I was hoping you might be able to give me a visual what the campus or the site looks like now. Mm-hmm. As I'm thinking about what you're trying to do here, and I agree that, you know, a smaller setting would certainly be a better quality of life for the patients and their families. Mm-hmm. Yet it seems to me that you're going to need similar types of equipment that you probably mm-hmm. house at one spot that now have to be at four different sites. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that has to contribute to the increased cost. I'm wondering, is there a way to do a campus-type setting where you have units that are maybe four to six beds, but they're not connected to one individual building? So you have an access to one set of equipment if there's an emergency or whatever, that storehouse for your prescriptions, so that there isn't mistakes that are made, things like that. Someone, one person in charge, maybe can reduce the staff size because they can handle a little bit more, but then have outer, you know, buildings that are on the campus to give that more intimate or, you know, private setting. Do you have enough acreage to do that, or is there a possibility, instead of finding four different locations, that you could do something like that?
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, generally not. I'm aware of one organization that did that, and it took a special act by the legislature to allow that to happen. Generally, what is encouraged when you develop community facilities is that they are spread apart from each other, so that you don't create an over-concentration of homes and places. There's not enough room where we're currently located to build four homes or three homes. So I am aware that it's been done once before, but it was a very, very exceptional circumstance. And generally, what you want to do is you want to disperse homes across the cities so that they blend in with their surroundings.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Preby, what is the age of the residents that would be in the facility that would be receiving 24-hour care?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the age ranges at Brooklyn Park are the two youngest folks are 12 years old, and the oldest person is in his early 70s.
So I'm just talking about the house that you would be building for people that would not go out during the day but would have 24-hour care. What's the age of those individuals?
I don't know exactly the answer to that. I think I'd have to take a look at who's going where and determine that.
Well, Mr. Preby, maybe I could ask the question differently. Would they be staying at home 24 hours a day because of their age? Mm-hmm. Are they older individuals? Are they aging?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe so, but I really want to go back and check and see where our planning had people going before I commit myself to that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess the reason I asked the question, and I'm sure probably the wrath of the disability community will fall upon me now, but, you know, when we talk about people living in the community in a normal setting, when people get older and they do not have a disability, oftentimes when they need 24-hour-a-day care, they go to a nursing home. And a nursing home is not six beds.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could... Senator Gordon. Can I ask just one more question? And and then I would just say to Mr. Preby, when you come before the budget division, I hope you... I'm going to ask you if you'd have this broken down, because just sitting here figuring, let's say at the rate that you're getting now at $114,000 per person per year, that's what it figures out to, that's $690,000 for six people. Mm-hmm. So... let's say you have the six-bed unit. How many people would be working at that throughout the year? I mean, how many employees, if you have, let's just say you have, you know, two per shift or three per shift, how many total would there be, 20, 30, or 10 or 15? How many? Because I'm trying to figure out, let's say they're getting $20,000 a year, if there's 20, that's $400,000. And so I'm trying to figure that out. So, and I guess you don't have to answer that right now, but I wish that when this comes before the budget division that you could have that all broken down, because I'd be very interested to see that. And so if there's no other questions, Mr. Chairman, I would so move that, and now I've lost what number it is. It's 13, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file 1326 be recommended to pass and sent to the as amended and sent to the Finance Committee.
On Senator Coring's motion, any discussion? Is there anybody in the audience who wanted to speak with concerns? If not on the Coring motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Berglund.
And members of the committee, I have an amendment for Senate File 1965 that would change the enactment date from 2007 to 2008. So I'd like to move that A1 amendment.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is an issue that I worked on quite hard a number of years ago, having to do with variances from licensure disqualification. And so what the situation is today is that if you have committed a crime, you cannot get a license to work in any of our licensed facilities in the state. And we were working hard to try and change that, because oftentimes people rehabilitate their lives they go through treatment, they change their lives, and they want to give back to the very kind of people that they had been themselves before they got rehabilitation. Well, we weren't able to accomplish that. We struck a compromise with the governor's office that anyone who had been given a variance in the past prior to July 1st of 2005 could get another variance because they couldn't even change jobs. They couldn't move from one position to another position or work for one provider and move to another provider or get an advancement and become a supervisor without having a new variance, and they couldn't get a new variance. So we got that little part of the problem rectified, that anyone who already had received a variance in the past before the law was changed saying no variances could be given could get a new variance. And that applied only to individuals in the chemical dependency field. This bill would expand that very narrow exception where people who already have variances could get a new variance to corrections as well. And I think the same argument that applies in the chemical dependency field applies in the corrections field. People are being rehabilitated. If you have a correctional type facility that is licensed and you have individuals working in there who at one time had committed an offense and they have rehabilitated their lives and become counselors or something like that, and they've been given a variance in the past, that they should be able to get another variance so they can change jobs if they want to. That's all this bill does. I have with me today Dan Kane, the executive director of RS Eden, who called me requesting that this bill be put before us to talk about the need for it.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee again, Mr. Kane.
Thank you, Senator Marty, members of the committee. Just a couple points of clarification. First off, my name is Dan Kane, C-A-I-N. I'm the president of an organization called RS Eden that provides services in the area of substance abuse corrections, sober housing, electronic monitoring, and drug testing. And this bill relates to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 245, C, which were amended in 2005. Prior to 2005, anyone who had been disqualified from working in a program licensed by the Department of Human Services or the Department of Health could request a set-aside, and the Commissioner of Human Services could grant that set-aside after evaluating whether that person had been sufficiently rehabilitated. And the disqualifications for crimes, depending upon the crime, would be for either 7 years, 10 years, 15 years, or a permanent bar to disqualification. In 2005, the legislature changed language and added some 22 crimes to the crimes that would result in a permanent bar to being able to work in a program, which by itself would not have been a problem, but they also removed the Commissioner of Human Services' discretion to grant a set-aside once someone showed or could demonstrate rehabilitation. The result was that you had people who were in school to be chemical dependency counselors, who had internships to become licensed as chemical dependency counselors, who could not follow through on their license, and they were basically left out in the cold. The other thing that it did was it said if you had been granted a set-aside in the past, you could continue with your current employment in a licensed program, which effectively made you an indentured servant to that employer. In 2006, Senator Berglund introduced legislation that would eliminate that indentured servitude, if you will. It basically said if you were granted a set-aside prior to 2005, and you wish to change employment to another licensed program, that the commissioner should consider another set-aside. That would be presumed to be the case. and that was limited only to chemical dependency programs which served adults. The DHS licensing process has very limited impact on corrections programs, but it does have impact. Those programs that are residential programs that are licensed by the Department of Corrections also have a board and lodging license from the Department of Health for special needs. And consequently, the background checks of 245C do come into play. This bill would impact on a relatively few number of people who have crimes which would result in permanent bars to employment were they to come to work today, but they've worked in the programs for lengthy periods of time, so much so that they were granted a set-aside prior to 2005, and they now have another 3 years of employment, crime-free and responsible behavior. The reason why this is important to both corrections and chemical dependency is that in many cases, these folks act as counselor role models, one of the most powerful change agents that we have in our programs. And to deny them the portability of going from one job to the other really hampers their career, limits our ability to hire people, and I mean it presents problems that, you know, we certainly would wish that they're not there. Now, again, this is a carryover from last year, and I'm aware that tomorrow in Senator Mua's committee there will be a presentation by the Collateral Sanctions Committee of a report entitled Criminal Records and Expungements in the State of Minnesota. There will be a recommendation in this committee, and I don't know if there's an author or if there's legislation as of yet, that would essentially recommend the elimination of permanent bars. Permanent bars say that you can never be rehabilitated, and we have that for 22 crimes, or at least you can never be rehabilitated enough to move into the mainstream and get these jobs. So this recommendation will come out of the presentation in Senator Mua's committee tomorrow. But I would ask that this committee pass this legislation on the off chance that something doesn't come out of the committee in Senator Mua's committee. It, as I said, impacts on a very few number of people. It impacts on people who have demonstrated beyond a doubt that they're rehabilitated, and it impacts on people who are extremely effective in the services that they provide.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Senator Berglund, on this 2005 change in the law, was that the time we had that fight on the Senate floor that was pretty ugly, where people refused to vote?
That was the bill where we were trying to go beyond what we actually ended up getting passed.
Okay.
Yes.
The reason I ask it, we've had so much, the Poverty Commission has been traveling around the state, and one of the number one things we're finding is people who have records 10 years, 15 years old, they can't get a job anywhere, and basically they've got a life sentence and have no way to do it. So, no, I appreciate that, and I wonder why you're not going one step further if you think the recommendation tomorrow is going to be to remove the permanent disqualification and at least say that the commissioner variances could go back for people after 2005.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would like to see this bill proceed because we might get this bill passed. I don't think that's going to get passed and signed into law. And I think it should, but I don't think it will. So, you know, I would be happy to work with anybody who wants to pursue that recommendation. In the meantime, I think this is such a small change that we should be able to try to pass it.
Mr. King?
Senator Marty, members of the committee, I just want, I don't mean to be so presumptuous as to correct the committee, but we're using the language variance and set-aside interchangeably, and they're not. They're very different things, and a set-aside of a disqualification has been the process wherein the licensing division of the Department of Human Services conducts an investigation, makes a recommendation to the commissioner, and the commissioner, based upon that investigation grants a set-aside. A variance is something that a program has to ask for. The program asks for a variance to allow someone whose set-aside is not yet permanent to work under supervision, and it requires sight and sound supervision of the counselor, so consequently it becomes burdensome for the program. So if I could just make that clarification and request that we talk in terms of set-asides.
Okay. Well, in that case, Senator Bergo, and I understand that it's something you don't think could pass, and I agree with you, it probably wouldn't pass to remove the permanent disqualification, but you don't think you could get through even the allowing the commissioner to set aside cases after July 2005?
That is what we were trying to do in the previous legislation, and we finally got an agreement that the governor would sign what we have in law now, and that's why we passed it in that form.
Okay. I remember former Senator Neville was fighting hard to help on this.
Yes, it was really an effort on a bipartisan basis, and all of you who were here then, I thank you very much for your support on it. Mr. Chair.
Well, for people who have very little chance of finding jobs, I think this, and Senator Higgins, you have a major bill on this related issue, right?
That's right. We have Mr. Kane was part of a really good task force on reentry issues that worked over the interim, and we have a pretty bold proposal that I know you signed on to it. Thank you. Senator Berglund, did we get you too? So we've got some good people who are going to try and help even farther. This is a good first step, and we ought to not lose the opportunity to do this piece of it. But there is so much more that we need to do. Today is Second Chance Day on the Hill, and I don't know if you happened to catch the folks who were in the rotunda today, but several of them came up to say hello and to thank us for the efforts that the legislature has been working on in the last couple of years. They see a real change in philosophy here that will, I think, ultimately help some people with some housing and jobs and, kind of that feeling they have paid a debt to society. They indeed are rehabilitated, and they need a job. They need a place to live, and they will hold up their end. And so I think, the committee will be hearing more about these issues in the next few weeks, but... I definitely support this bill, and let's get this piece passed right away.
Further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 1965, as amended, be recommended passed. Does this go to the floor?
Yes.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Before we adjourn, I wanted to reiterate a couple of things and also introduce staff changes that we've had. First of all, Laura is now the new committee administrator. Kara is come from the education committee and is now the committee legislative assistant. Kara back there is the committee clerk for our committee and Senator Higgins's committee. And Zeb is our committee intern over here. We've had a number of changes, and then the business items I said at the beginning, some of you heard, were that we're going to have several large healthcare reform packages. Some of them aren't ready yet, and so we'll be interspersing them in the course of the session. If some of you have some, like I know the Republican caucus may have one, get them to us as soon as you can. We will give those bills priority, but we do have a large number of other bills, and I've already announced earlier that we will be meeting evenings because of some of that. And Senator Coring made a good point about trying to get people here on time. So please try and make it on time to the meetings. And then with that,
Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that you know, it was almost 2 o'clock before we had a quorum, so I know that I'm, and I'm not trying to scold other members, that's up to them, but I know that I'm going to make an extra effort, and I've been negligent of getting here on time, but I'm going to make an extra effort this year to try to get here on time, and so I'm hoping I'll be sitting in my chair right at the time to start so that we can do the people's work. Thank you.
I think a lot of us have a need to work on that, so speaking for myself and I think a lot of us, let's try and do that. If there's no further business, this committee is adjourned until Monday.